If you are looking to elevate your leadership and drive your nonprofit forward, I invite you to subscribe to the Successful Nonprofits newsletter. Every week, I curate exclusive, shareworthy content that sparks inspiration, innovation, and conversation. From the latest trends to timeless advice, the weekly email newsletter is your all-access pass to a treasure trove of resources. But receiving the newsletter is not just about staying informed. It's also about getting our best content first. Subscribers get first access to our newest downloadable templates designed to propel your leadership and amplify your impact. And that's not all, my friend. We are constantly working on new ways to support you and your mission. So as a subscriber, you'll get updates on our latest projects, opportunities to participate in surveys, and a say in the topics that we tackle next. You will essentially get me as a consultant, coach, and confidant in your inbox, ready to help you navigate the challenges of nonprofit leadership. So if you're an executive director, board chair, or a nonprofit leader who believes in making a difference, join me as a newsletter subscriber. Visit successfulnonprofits.com/newsletter to sign up today. And now, friend, let me take you to the episode you've downloaded. Welcome to the Successful Nonprofits Podcast. I'm your host, Dolph Goldenberg. And friend, today we are going to be joined by Darren Isom, and he and I are going to be having a conversation around amplifying the voices of BIPOC leaders. Darren is a thought leader in the nonprofit sector. And by the way, when I say thought leader, one of the things I really like about Darren are the many different roles that he has played in the sector. So he is currently a partner at the Bridgespan Group, where he advises clients and also Bridgespan on equity and justice, and also works with the firm's arts and culture organizations. I'd already mentioned that he has had multiple roles in the sector, and one of those that I was very intrigued by is that he is founder and was executive director of the Memphis Music Initiative, a $20 million grant-making and community arts initiative. Now, if you read Harvard Business Review, what we sometimes call HBR, or the Stanford Social Innovation Review, or even visit Bridgespan.org much, you have undoubtedly seen some of the articles that he has done around racial equity and philanthropy. In addition to all of that, so all I can say is Darren's got to be a busy person, because in addition to all of that, Darren hosts the Dreaming in Color podcast, which is grounded in his queer Black experience and invites listeners into the candid kitchen table conversations that have long helped shape the journeys of BIPOC leaders. Darren, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, hello, Dolph. Great to be here.
I know that you start each of your episodes of Dreaming in Color by inviting the guest to share an invocation. I'd like to do the same with you.
Thank you. And so, yes, definitely one of our traditions. And as a good Jesuit New Orleans boy, grew up with invocations as part of every group gathering of sorts. And fret not, I will not read the Bible and some good verses here and there, right? A lot of bad ones too. But I do encourage my guests to come in with a quote or a poem as a way of kind of shaping the conversation, making sure that I'm in their headspace as we have the conversation. So I thought I'd bring in one for me and one that's been on my mind now. It's Wild Mercy by Terry Tempest Williams. They as the future looking back at us, and they are praying for us to see beyond our own time. They are kneeling with hands clasped that we might act with restraint, that we might leave room for the life that is destined to come. To protect what is wild is to protect what is gentle. Perhaps the wilderness we fear is the pause between our own heartbeats, the silent space that says we live only by grace. Wilderness lives by the same grace. Wild mercy is in our hands.
Mm. That is an incredibly powerful quote. And some of the themes I hear in there that I've read in your writings are restraint, also spaces and wilderness. Can you say some more about that?
Oh, yeah, totally. And so one of the things that excites me the most about the world that we're in and also the space to occupy in this world is that it's changing. We're living in a very changing world. things are in such flex and flux, and there are many of us that are very comfortable with ambiguity. I'm one of those people, but even I am a bit overwhelmed at times, right? And so I tell this story all the time. It's one that came up in a piece that I was in Nonprofit Quarterly, where we're talking about the space beyond imagining a new world, which is kind of the role of people of color in this world that we're in. And I talk about Urvashi Vaid, who was one of the first people that I interviewed on my podcast. But I don't talk about at that point because she hadn't said it yet. But I'm the member of the Donors of Color Network, a board of an organization of high net worth people of color and advocates creating new worlds. Think what that world might look like. And we had our convening at some point, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, this before Urvashi passed. And she couldn't attend the convening because she was dealing with chemo then. It was COVID times. And remember that world? It wasn't that long ago. But she did the last session where she looked up this group of people of color all working in philanthropy and advocacy spaces trying to change the world. And we looked, you can imagine what we looked like. We'd spent 2 days talking about the world and how we're going to fix it. She looks out on us and she's like, I know the world feels overwhelming right now. And I know that it's easy to feel dispirited and hopeless. But I want you to know that this is what winning looks like. Winning looks like chaos. And I want you to look around the room. This is what a winning team looks like. Keep doing the work. Right? Mm. And so I hold on to that so much in the space in the world that we're in. I think so much of us are doing great work. I joke that the negative powers, well, they're putting up a good fight, but we got a winning team and we're putting up a good fight too. Right. And so I feel that people should feel some degree of comfort in that. And I quote Octavia Butler all the time as well on my podcast and in life in general, where she says, there's nothing new under the sun, but there are new suns. And there's so much of us, our job is to just throw a new sun up there and have people live under it. So excited about that in the work. So hope the poem gets at that.
I will say, I think you might be the first person that I've had on the podcast who brings poetry to their practice. And that's super cool.
I mean, listen, I joke all the time that I don't read nonfiction, because I kind of feel like life gives me enough nonfiction. But I read fiction because I feel like it's a lot easier to capture life and its possibilities through fiction. There's something very magical about living.
Now, one of the things you mentioned was a powerful conversation that you had with Urvashi. And that makes me immediately think about the fact that much of the work you've been publishing on over the last year or two is based on, I think, a core of 25 interviews where you interviewed leaders of color across the sector, both in the nonprofit side and the philanthropy side or the funder side. Can you share a little bit about some of the key lessons that you've taken away from those interviews?
Yeah. And so those conversations were all really interesting. I joke all the time, I have the best job in the world because I get to talk with cool, smart folks and pick up on their motivation, their thinking. And the folks are just genius, right? So it's really fun. It was fun for me. The depths of the COVID period, I want to acknowledge first as well the period that we've lived through, right? So we lived through 4 years of a presidency that we can name at best disruptive.
At
right?
best.
We had at best. I'm being charitable. I'm going to continue with my charity, right? We then had a whole COVID epidemic. I mean, like a world pandemic. I mean, this comes once every 100 years, right? We had a whole civil rights movement in the middle of that period. Right. And so we've been living through some fairly chaotic times. And so these conversations were actually happening in the middle of all that. And they were very soothing and comforting conversations for me. So we got to interview leaders of color across the space, philanthropy, nonprofit organizations. And the goal was to really get a sense of, you know, their path to leadership. And in many ways, you know, what were the things that they thought they brought to the work that was different? Or the same in some ways, but just with different aspect, right? If there's nothing under the sun, but there are new suns. And so those conversations were really powerful for a number of reasons. One, I realized very quickly that it was the first time that a lot of these people who were fairly senior in their careers were asked to talk about their personal life experiences in a positive way, right? And So often, those things that, you know, are seen as things to be marginal, that create systems or that fall under systems of marginalization are seen as liabilities, right? When in actuality, those things are your biggest assets. I joke all the time, am I being gay and am I being Black are like my biggest assets from a work perspective, right? But you also know that the things that if you don't overcome them as liabilities earlier in your career, they become assets later in your career, right? But they can take you out earlier too as well, right? So giving people the space to talk about their different life experiences. And I joke all the time, I don't know if you've read Kinji Yoshino on the whole covering theory, how we cover things about ourselves that may not be as palatable for others, right? We learn how to do that extremely well. But giving people space to talk about those differences in a positive way, it was really powerful for them. It was the first time they were being asked for many of them. And so it was also a way for them to honor their experiences and the people that brought them to who they were. And so they were very affirming and positive conversations for them. And I think about many of the folks who pointed out people early in their careers, before they had careers, like middle school teachers, neighborhood folks who saw something in them or encouraged them to live differently or lead differently or brought things to them that became professional assets. And I'm reminded of the, I don't know if you've seen the, sorry, Welcome to Conversation with Darren Dolph. I just pulled from all over the place. But the former Vogue editor, Andrea Leontali, who was a force, was a Vogue editor. He was basically centering the world of fashion. Great big old black guy from North Carolina. He worked at Vogue. He worked at W Magazine. He worked under Andy Warhol. He worked in Paris. He'd done all the things. And the interviewer asked him, you know, where did he get this biggest inspiration from a fashion perspective? And he said, everything I needed to know about fashion, I learned not in Paris, not in New York. Everything I needed to know about fashion, I learned watching my grandmother get dressed for church as a young boy in Raleigh, North Carolina, right? And so I think there's a way that we can, many of us see these things that were early life influences that really shaped who we are and how we think about the work itself. I think it was also interesting as well because they got to talk about not only their vision of the world and what they're hoping to achieve, but more importantly, I think that being a person of color, being in this space, you have to calibrate some conflicting narratives in order to be happy, right? In order to be successful. And hearing the ingenuity with which people have created and crafted narratives around the work and the impact they hope to seek is, you know, it's really powerful. I joke all the time that Black Americans are just expert storytellers in general because we had to tell stories around things that really didn't make much sense. So we had to use storytelling to really get at the core of things. I joke all the time, like we're people who literally were joining Christianity back when we were being told that Blacks couldn't get into heaven. Clearly you had to make your own story. That one wasn't going to work. Right. So and so the ability to tell new stories in ways are creative and powerful. And also just to honor the fact that I joke all the time within my work as well, that the biggest marker of white privilege within a professional space is being able to achieve great things without having social skills. I see all these white boys all the time, senior positions, like, have you never talked to anyone before? How did you get where you are? Right. If I could not talk to folks, I would have never left my stoop in New Orleans. Right. And so these are really just, you know, effective, thoughtful, warm, sincere people's conversations were powerful. What we learned is laid out in the article that was both in HBR and SSIR in some form, and that ultimately they had to gain a different set of skills from a life perspective. And so we make it perfectly clear that the leadership skills that people of color have, they aren't necessarily born with them, right? It's just how they navigate the life and their identities force a certain navigation of life that in doing so, you gain a certain set of skills, right? You've had to navigate rooms where you weren't accepted, or there were, you weren't necessarily seen as someone that belonged there. You had to be able to, in some ways, make friends and with folks who were very different from you. You had to, in many ways, see success as not personal, but community driven. So your community became both, it became your biggest asset, right? And it's very counter how the American system thinks about success. I joke all the time that Black American leaders are the only leaders that can credibly stand in front of a room of people and talk about success three generations away, right? My grandchildren will see this world that I will never see, right? That's whereas, you know, I think that within the white American standard, basically, you think about success within your lifetime, the success that you're going to bring about. So we have to see into the future and think about the world that we're creating. And I think that we also just have to bring others along with us from a storytelling perspective as well. So conversations were wonderful. I think it gave me an appreciation of how folks have navigated the world differently and with it developed different skill sets. I think it also, and this comes out both in the article and also in a piece that came a little bit later where this came under the racial equity and philanthropy work that we're doing at Bridgeband. So I advised on this work, but didn't lead it directly, where we're talking with Liz Thompson, who leads the 1954 project. And she's talking about her philanthropic approach. And I remember when we were developing that project itself, we came to the conversation with, you know, West Coasters, we're here in California. So we have these values that will guide the conversation and the work. And one of them was love, the value of love, centering love in the work itself. And she's in Chicago. So we're used to putting it out on the table and having these East Coast folks being like, no, what is number four on slide seven? What is this, right? And she looked at it and she's like, I love this. I love that we're centering love in the work. Because I've said all the time that as leaders of color in this world, we love our communities. And that love is a very different way of interacting. There's a difference between working with someone because you're contractually obligated to work with them, or because intellectually you think you can help them, as opposed to working with them because you actually love them. Because all that's done in love is done well. Right. And so I think bringing that love to the work, bringing that personalization and community uplifting to the work, it produces different answers and you interact with people very differently.
I'd love to stay with that, bringing the love. I know you talk about some ways that BIPOC leaders can inform everybody's leadership practice. And one of those, I think, is leading others. And, you talk about things like empathy and love and ways in which that really can inform everyone's leadership practice.
Yeah. And so I think it's very commonplace, particularly if you're from a marginalized group, be it Black, be it queer, be it a woman even, right, from an impact perspective, being able to see a little bit of yourself in the work itself. But I think it's also, the good Quaker upbringing will remind you that there's a little bit of God in all of us, right? And so this idea of how do we honor that God in each of us? How do we see it and honor it? I think leaders of color do that really well. And so I think there's something beautiful from a leadership perspective in watching how leaders of color bring others into the work, into the thinking, how they allow people to honor themselves in their spaces in the thinking as well. It's why leaders of color make, in many ways, for better leaders, right? From a space perspective, from a growth perspective, from a community perspective. I think it's also, and I say this jokingly as a Gen Xer, we're seeing a huge generational shift within the work itself, right? So we have the baby boomers, thank God, are finally stepping down. And then we have, and the millennials are stepping into power. Gen Xers, we're here. We don't really want to be here. I mean, we've never really wanted to be here. And we were happily forgotten about. And no one's complaining when we say that, right? And we're ready to step down as soon as possible. But the way the numbers work out, we have to be in leadership positions for a little bit, right? And so I think that there is also a way that you develop the work knowing that you can't do it on your own, that it takes a team. It takes a team leveraging their skills and their abilities. I think that's a very different way of leading. And you see this with leaders of color in the space. They recognize they have a certain set of skills. They also have blind spots and liabilities, right? And so you develop a team where everyone can bring the best of themselves into the work. And it's the teamwork that actually makes the work happen well.
I have to take just a quick aside. So I know early on in our conversation, you mentioned, Jesuit influences in New Orleans. And then you just mentioned that of God and in everyone. From the Quakers. So I just have to ask real quick, did you grow up as a Quaker?
I did not. I grew up religiously, right? And so I grew up in a good New Orleans home where, New Orleans in many ways has always been fighting with Catholicism in the best way possible. And so my dad was Catholic, my mom was Baptist, which in New Orleans means the boys are baptized Baptist and the girls are christened. The boys are baptized Catholic, excuse me, and the girls are christened Baptist, but it also means that you go to church with your mom every Sunday, except for four or five high holidays out of the year you go with your dad, right? And your dad's at church with your mom as well on the weekends. And so I was raised religiously. I did grow up, luckily, in that window of Black liberation ideology. And so the church was a very progressive place. I don't think it was intentional. I think it was just, God was so great and so good. And man was so small and so flawed, right, that there just had to be, there was something about the goodness of God that set in all of us. I taught at Sidwell Friends at some point when I was in college and did some work there with the Summer Bridge program, so Breakthrough Collaborative, and definitely spent a couple of years as a Quaker in college as I was doing some religious exploration. I landed at Unitarian Universalism, and that's where I am now, but appreciate the role that the Quakers have played from an educating perspective, and also the basic tenet of Quakerism, this idea that there's a little bit of God in all of us, which, and created a great degree of progressivism. They were the first abolitionists because you can't enslave God, right? I think there's some working philosophies within all the religions that I find very beautiful and very powerful. My grandmother used to always say the whole point of religion was to make us nicer. And if religion didn't make us nicer, then let it go. If religion wasn't helping you to be a nicer person, please don't. Just don't be religious. Find something else, right? And so looking for that, I think, becomes really important. It's been a life lesson for me.
I wanted to ask that question because starting in my teens and then for a couple decades, I attended Quaker meetings. So I was like, oh my gosh. And I now joke, I now belong to the religion of the New York Times is interesting and my bed is very warm on any Sunday or Saturday morning.
100%. Well, I mean, I definitely spent 2 years going to Quaker sessions. I just grew up in a very vibrant church environment. And so, the idea that you could go to a session and it could be absolutely wonderful as three or four people spoke or nothing happened. That killed me, right? I couldn't do it. And you know, I fight with Unitarians all the time as well, because it's like, okay, you know, like, you know, sometimes you go to Unitarian church and it's like, oh, we're, you know, you go three Sundays without anybody talking about Jesus. So I was like, we can talk about Jesus, right? Like one Sunday a month at least, right? Yeah. Like it's okay, right? But yeah, so
I just have to share with you one more thing about my Quaker journey, and then I swear we're going to get back to the topic. So I moved to Philadelphia, and that's actually where I lost my Quakerism.
Interesting. In Philly.
In Philly. Yeah, that's 100% where I was like, okay, yeah, I guess the New York Times is interesting and my bed is warm now. But so one of the things that was, as we had that little bit of a tangent to chat about religion, one of the things that you had mentioned brought me back to something else that you had written about ways that BIPOC leaders can inform everyone's leadership practice. And that's kind of an asset-based lens, because when you were talking about your religious upbringing, you said, you know, liberation theology was really big back then. Like me, you know, you're also queer. And so my very initial thought was, okay, you know, religion's not always friendly for everyone, but it's so clear that you are taking that asset-based lens. Like, okay, what did I get from an experience?
Yeah, no, totally. I don't. So religion, I grew up in a very progressive Black church. It's funny because my sister and I, we talk about this all the time, how we went off to college and we realized that everyone who was raised religiously wasn't raised like us. And so, you know, and I always caveat anything religious by saying that I know that people had very negative experiences in the church. And so I do not mean to trigger anyone. Right. And I say this as a queer guy. Right. Like, I know that people were, they were going through hell in those churches, right? And that was not my experience, right? And so, you know, I think that it was, we were all absolutely perfect and wonderful. It was God's creation, right? And my gayness was just as much of an asset as anyone else's. I think it was also Black liberation theology is that the world was oppressive enough. If anywhere else, we were equal and free in the eyes of God. And on Sunday, it was one day of freedom, right? And so I joke all the time that I was very attentive as a child in church. I don't remember anyone ever saying anything remotely homophobic, right? Like, I remember there was this one minister that said something that was sexist at some point, and all the women in church started hissing. And he was like, well, I guess I should sit down. And my grandmother screamed out, amen. Yes, you should.
Wow. Right?
So, you know, and so I think that there's definitely spaces and narratives about the work. I tell this story all the time, Dolph. I'll share this with you quickly. About I had three big coming outs with my mom. And so I came home from college. I went to Howard for undergrad. And you know, all the cool kids were giving up meat. So I gave up meat, came home to New Orleans at Christmas and told my mom that I was vegetarian. My mother cried. Right. And, you know, I kept passing out because I'd grown up in a meat, starch, and vegetable home. And I was only eating starch and vegetable, and that you can't do it. My doctor was like, okay, you have to eat meat. Come back this summer. We'll figure out. Your diet, you got to get protein, whatever, we'll figure it out. I started eating meat, never stopped again. I came home my junior year of college, studied abroad in Paris, and I was having, like all good Christian kids, I was having a crisis of faith. And I told my mom that I don't think I believed in God anymore. And my mom said, that's okay, I'm sure God still believes in you. Completely unfazed, right? And then I came home my first year of grad school. I went to grad school in Paris, my first grad degree. I went to the Fulbright in Paris. And I told my mother outed me. She asked me if my roommate was actually my boyfriend, if I were gay. And I said, yes, I am. And my mother said, you're not the only one, completely unfazed. So many years later, I asked her, of all the things I've ever shared with you, the only thing that's got a visceral response was my being vegetarian. My mother said, well, your father and I have only ever wanted for you to be happy. And I saw no path to happiness as vegetarian. That just made me sad for you. What a horrible lifestyle to choose for yourself, right? So that's the home that I grew up in, right? And so I think that we all have unique experiences, but it's important for us to tell our stories where others may model themselves after them or see a bit of themselves in those stories as well.
And let me say, in addition to an asset-based lens, wow, like your mom was really demonstrating radical imagination there.
Well, you know, I come from a New Orleans family. And yeah, I had a great grandfather who was gay back in the 30s, right? Divorced his wife and lived with his partner and Marini. I think it's also interesting as well when you normalize within various stories. And so it's interesting, I think about this now all the time. Being in New Orleans in that period, there was a certain expectation of cosmopolitanism that was part of being a city dweller. Right? Like this idea of being narrow-minded and that was so provincial, right? So it's like, you know, even when my husband is Chinese American, Californian. And I remember, you know, bring him home to New Orleans and, you know, just gave my mom a heads up. My parents a heads up. My husband's Chinese American. Right? My mother was like, so like, just almost like, how dare you? We're city people. Like what? I don't need a warning, right? Like, and so I think there's something to be said about this appreciation of cosmopolitanism and progressivism as a city value, right? It's what distinguished us from the folks out in the countryside. right? And if you live towards that value, it's a narrative to live under, right? And so, I mean, that's another conversation for another day over cocktails as well, how that transfers to my political thinking. But I think there's something powerful in giving people the spaces to think progressively and the handrails to see progressive thinking as normal. And in fact, best practices, right? If we're trying to build the world that we're trying to build.
Darren, there's a question that I planned for you.
Of course.
That is actually, this is the perfect time for me to take us there. So in one of the articles that you co-wrote, you have the question, how do we make sure things at an organization meaningfully change besides just the faces around a table?
Yeah. And so that's been, in many ways, the anchoring question of all of my work, right? I think that we, you know, I tell the story all the time that I grew up in. I was Gen Xers. We're Sesame Street generation. Like, my family's been in New Orleans for some 9 generations now. I'm a 7 generation New Orleans involved. I've expatriated to California. And I was the only generation that grew up in integrated schools. They were de jure segregated before me and de facto segregated after me because all the whites left the city, right? And so I recognize, you know, that I grew up in a very, I was a product of someone's imagination. We were coming out of the country's most violent civil rights movement, right? And our parents set us down in front of Sesame Street, and we normalize everybody working together, singing between Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers, 51 Contact. I think about what a dreamy experiment, which was my childhood. And yeah, your parents weren't, I mean, shout out to the baby boomers that raised us, but they weren't really doing our, we were the most feral generation. We were left on our own. Our parents were working, right? And we were raising each other and being raised by TV. And so I think that the idea of that generation was that if they put us all together, right, this is like this superficial Benetton ad, diversity, right, that we would be able to bring all of ourselves to the table and actually benefit from each other's diversity. For me, that requires our putting people together in a way in which they have equal footing, right? And there's not this desire to assimilate or to honor one person, particularly the white perspective, more than the other. And so the work becomes, how do you bring together a diverse group of folks with diversity of experiences, not just to have a wonderful McDonald's commercial or Benetton ad for generational folks who get that, but to make sure that that diversity of thought is respected and brought into the work. And I say this not because I just love diversity for the sake of diversity. I think that's how we win, right? Like, clearly, we're not going to smart white boy our way out of the world that we're in now. We've had enough smart white boys. They've given us all the ideas they can give us, right? And it's not working, right? So we have to bring in more ideas, more thinking. I think that our genius lies in those communities that we've ignored in the past. And I think that we get to success by honoring that thinking, honoring that genius, and making sure that people's experiences, those jewels, those gems that have made them who they are, that they're allowed to shine and really shape the American narrative.
Darren, that is such a good place for us to do our pivot and go to two truths and a lie.
I know. And no, I was going to throw out the one about being raised religiously as a lie, as a false lie, because it's one that people don't usually think of. So let's see. Two truths and a lie. How about this one? I am incredibly short. I am French speaking. Or I am just back from a trip to Beirut.
Okay. Well, I know you went to school in France, so I'm going to assume you are French speaking. So now I have to decide whether you just came back from Beirut or you're incredibly short. And I am 5'2" tall. And I always say to people, you and I are on Zoom right now, when they meet me for the first time in person, I always say I'm much bigger on Zoom than I am in reality. So I would like to think that you also are short. So I'm going to guess that that's the truth.
No, I'm actually 6'2".
Wah, but, wah.
But I just, I'm actually 6'2". That's the lie, right? And I'm back from a trip to Beirut. I was actually in Beirut during my sabbatical. I just come back from 3 months of sabbatical, and I spent some of that time in Lebanon, which is a beautiful country.
Oh my gosh. So I love that you just let it slip. Okay, so talk to us about your sabbatical in Lebanon for a quick minute.
Oh, well, I spent most of my time actually in Paris. So I was 3 months away. My husband and I did part of the trip together. We were in Provençal for a bit. We were in the south of France for a bit. And then I was anchored in Paris, as I've had a few transformative periods of relaxing in Paris. And then I did a few small trips so to Tunis, to Lebanon, to Beirut, and then to also to Mallorca, just a way of kind of experience. I love the Mediterranean, Middle Eastern region. It's a beautiful region, just rich culturally, historically, the height of cosmopolitanism. I joke all the time that cities like Marrakesh, Mallorca, Beirut, Malaga, and Barcelona have more in common with each other than they do with the other countries that they share, right? We just don't talk about that. And also, I think this idea of narrative bending, recognizing that those spaces have been the height of cosmopolitanism and cultural, how do we honor that as something we should still keep thinking about in the work itself. So love those spaces. It was very relaxing. I encourage everyone to take time off. I think that being, you know, there's another conversation on how do you find rest in a world that's on fire. All right, so I arrived in Beirut October 6th. and so, but I think that we're in a world that's on fire, and it's going to be that way for a while, right? And so we have to think about how do we find spaces to recover, to recuperate, to think more broadly, think about the future world that we're creating and not get bogged down in the reality that we're in right now.
Darren, thank you. I especially like that message. It's something I need to be thinking about myself, which is how do I take rest in a world that's on fire?
We have to take rest. We have to be able to take care of ourselves. You know, if Kissinger is going to live to be 100, I'm sure Dick Cheney is going to live to be 110. We have to outlive these folks, right? There's no way. We have to outlive these folks. My mother always says, like, take care of yourself. You have no use to anyone dead, right? And so really thinking about how do we play the long game, and something we're not used to, but something we have to be thinking about. And rest, relaxation, and actually allowing us to unlock our genius is important as part of that process.
It's funny you mentioned Dick Cheney. There's a song in my queue right now, on one of my playlists right now, called You're Going to Outlive Dick Cheney. And every time it comes up, it brings me joy. It's just like, oh, yes, it's good to know. It's good to know that I will live in a world without Dick Cheney.
It's coming. It's coming. I joke, I guess I say don't repeat this, but you can repeat this. I hold two bottles of champagne in my refrigerator. One for unexpected good news. Right, because you never know. You have to be ready. And second, for the news of Clarence Thomas's death. Right, you have to be ready. Right.
So yeah. I just want to check. It's okay for us to leave that in.
I'm 100%.
Okay.
I'm a full blown Clarence Thomas hater. The world knows that.
Right? I've never thought about that, but I might have to put a bottle in the fridge.
Listen,
just for that very reason.
You got to be ready. You got to be ready.
Oh my God, that's awesome. Well, Darren, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Of course. Thanks a bunch. It's been great.
And I always want to make sure that anyone who's listening knows ways that they can connect with you. And so, friend, there's a few things I want you to do. First of all, clearly you listen to podcasts because you've made it 30 minutes plus into this podcast. So I want you to pick up your phone and look up Dreaming in Color podcast. Currently, I think there are about 17 episodes that are out, and it's already in the top 2.5% globally. And by the way, I just have to share with you, friend, that I think this podcast was out for like 4 or 5 years before we hit that. So the fact that Darren's has done that in under 20 episodes probably means this is a podcast you should check out.
Dolph, we're trying something new with this season that's just out. And so we're going to have a younger generation of leaders within BridgeBand leading those conversations. So already Gen Xer is passing the mic to the millennials to take us through our next set. So we're going to have a younger generation of interviews and interviewers led by my colleague, Christian Celeste Tate, an Anam Kidder. And then I'll pick up with the fourth season afterwards.
And it's interesting that you say that, Darren, because you're the one who's like, yeah, those of us in Gen X, we're going to lead for some short period of time. And then we're like, okay, I'm out. I'm done.
We're not going to Feinstein. We're not Feinstein in our way through. We're ready to step down already.
Love it. Love it. Love it. A couple more things, friend. First of all, you can also go to bridgebrandgroup.org to contact Darren. And if you want to read some of the things that he has co-written or written, you can go to HBR or SSIR, and we are going to link to all of those in our show notes. Darren, again, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me. This has been wonderful.
Okay. And you know, friend, I always want to just share with you that if you like this episode, there's two more you should consider. The first is episode 185, 6 ways your nonprofit can be more trans inclusive with Andy Mara. Andy, as you may remember, is the executive director of the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund, a national advocacy group. And such a great conversation. I will share with you on that episode, her audio is not quite what we normally strive for. And we actually debated, oh my gosh, should we release it or should we not? But we decided to release it because it was that good. We're like, there's no way we're ever going to be able to recreate this. So we're going to put it out there in the world. The second is episode 214, Gender Matters in Philanthropy with Jeannie Sager. That, my friend, is our show for the week. I hope that you have gained some insight to help you and your nonprofit thrive. And the lawyers make me say it. Otherwise, honestly, I wouldn't. I think everybody should know this, that I'm not an accountant nor an attorney. And you know that because Esquire is not after my name. CPA is not after my name. Come on, I'm not an accountant nor an attorney. And neither I nor this consulting practice nor this podcast provide tax, legal, or accounting advice. For the love of all things that you care about, especially not getting in trouble with the IRS or the law, do not rely on this podcast for tax, legal, or accounting advice. If that is what you need, please find a licensed, qualified person in your area. And if you're not sure what type of professional you need, like you might know you need a lawyer, but what's the specialty and you don't know anyone in that specialty, you can reach out to me. If I know someone, I'm happy to connect you.